Hello. We're doing the nose. We're live here on Friday afternoon. I hope you're live here on Friday afternoon, but whenever you're listening, we're about to talk about, I think, maybe one of the more addictive pieces of television available to us this summer. New. It's called Ozark. It's on Netflix. It has an interesting cast and a very interesting premise. A little bit later in the show, we will share our remembrances or our favorite things about the late Sam Shepard. And we will also talk in a very abstract way about Sharknado 5. I mean, the problem being most of us have not seen the first four Sharknados, although some of us have seen little bits and pieces of Sharknados, which is the best way to consume them, and it's the best way for sharks to consume people, too, in bits and pieces. So joining us today is a fabulous panel. Rich Holland is a principal and design director at CoLab. Rebecca Castellani is a Queen of the Andals, Lord of the North, and entertainment director at Bridge Street Live in Canton, Connecticut. And Susan Campbell is the author. She's many other things besides this, but she's the author of the upcoming Searching for the American Dream in Frog Hollow. Pre-order it now at your favorite independent bookstore. Can the people pre-order it?
No, but that's a nice thought.
Okay, just make a note to yourself. You can't pre-order it, but you can make a note to yourself. People still do that. And one of the reasons I wanted Susan to be on today is because, well, first of all, because she was fulminating about Ozark, this new Netflix series on Facebook, and also because having sat next to her at work or across from her at work, depending on our desk configuration at the time, for 9 years, I know that she has some strong feelings about how a certain part of the country and a certain kind of person, sometimes referred to as a hillbilly, is portrayed in popular culture. And that is one of the things that this treats of. So before we plunge in, let me just quickly try to set the premise here. So Jason Bateman plays Marty Bird. Marty Bird is a seemingly kind of harmless, middle-of-the-road kind of person, except that his big secret is he's been laundering money. None of this is, by the way, we're not going to do any bad spoilers. This is just what rolls you into the first episode. He's been laundering money for a drug cartel, some very dangerous people. And his relationship with that drug cartel goes pretty seriously south right at the beginning of the first episode. It's ultimately going to require him and his family to relocate to the Lake of the Ozarks, where Marty has, because he is a great improviser, decided that he can do even greater work for the Mexican drug cartel, which is currently very unhappy with certain aspects of his work. You're going to hear an episode, a part of the first episode in which Marty, because he has to leave Chicago with his family, his wife, played Wendy, played by Laura Linney, and his two children, they're going to have to leave suddenly, and they're going to have to reconstitute their lives in this new area. So he goes into a Chicago bank for the purpose of withdrawing essentially all the money he has in the bank, and here's what that sounds like.
Good to see you, sir.
Yeah.
Can I get you a cup of coffee?
No, thank you. Am I under duress? No. What are you doing? No, there's been... No, stop that. There's been no kidnapping. I'm not wearing any wires. I have a business opportunity that requires cash.
Sir, yeah. There's no business opportunities that require that much cash. Not legal ones.
Well, I agree to disagree.
Where's my money? As we told you, we can't cover that amount within 24 hours.
Okay. There's two federal agents here, which means you wouldn't take the chance that there was a kidnapping and not have my money. So if you don't produce it immediately, I'm going to walk into that lobby and I'm going to tell these people that I can't get my money out. And we'll see how long that takes to go viral and you get a good old-fashioned run on this bank. And if I want to put all $7,945,400 into a hot tub, get buck naked, and play Scrooge McDuck, that is 100% my business. Now, where's my money?
All right. So before we get into some of the meaty issues around this, I mean, are we all I just want to go around the table. Are we all at least in agreement that that pulse-pounding music that we hear behind that scene pretty much approximates our reaction to this series? I mean, I think everybody here got
the
hooked,
duration
right?
of it. Yep.
Yeah.
Every
yeah.
second of it has that undertone.
Right.
Yeah. There's no happy music. It's all, oh, my God, something's around the corner.
And did you, in fact, were you hooked for the duration?
I was. I originally wasn't going to watch it because, oh, my God, I can tell you how this is going to look. Mm. And then New York Times gave it a kind of a tepid, yeah. And I thought, well, now I have to watch it. You know, now I want to see if they're right. So, yes, I was hooked pretty quickly.
And, Rebecca, you did pretty much what I did, right? I mean, yeah. Sacrificed.
That heartbeat sound of adrenaline was kind of what I was doing the whole time. I watched the whole thing in 2 days, which is really sad, but it was awesome.
I think it took me 4 or 5, but
yeah, very bingeable.
Any amount of discretionary time I had went into finishing this series. So I do want to begin with you, Susan, because one of the big questions about this is, does this in some way enlarge upon or improve upon the way this particular sector of American society is often portrayed? I mean, have we moved beyond? I don't even know. First of all, what's the most offensive portrayal of quote unquote hillbillies?
Oh God, there's so many. Uneducated and stupid, or educated but still stupid. Married their cousins, no teeth, no shoes.
I was actually thinking of a specific thing.
I'm just summing them all up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so like Deliverance takes place in Georgia, right? Those aren't hillbillies.
So they're not ours, so that's okay. They can say whatever they want to about them. I will say that, and I have given this way too much thought, as with the Beverly Hillbillies, the denizens of the Lake of the Ozarks come off to me in the beginning as, oh, my God, here we go again. But they have a native intelligence that I appreciate, and they can't be taken advantage of quite as easily as Jason Bateman's character appears to think.
Right. I mean, I think that that's kind of true across the board. I mean, we are Rich in particular introduced to a young woman named Ruth, people who are familiar with the actress Julia Gardner?
Gardner.
She's on The Americans most recently. But and she plays a very young woman, indigenous to this area, to the Lake of the Ozarks, who's every bit the intellectual and scheming equal of Mr. Bateman or Mr. Bird, who's no slouch himself.
Yeah, she's shrewd. She assesses what her risks are in a manner that's a lot more on beat than the guy whose job it is to be a risk assessor. To me, she is this series. If there were a spinoff on this, I would watch this for hours a day. She's, you know, completely magnetic, and her ethics are the most complicated ethics that that I've ever seen visualized. And I buy into it 100%. I mean, where her loyalties lie. You'd have to see it. I don't want to ruin it. But just if you watch this movie and you watch where her loyalties lie, it's really phenomenal. This series talks a lot about the choices that we make and how they're interconnected and that they define what our human experience is going to be and what we will amount to in the end. And to see the choices that she makes in process is just incredibly, incredibly phenomenal.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. I hadn't really thought about it. But in a way, a lot of the people in this series don't have a lot of flexibility in making choices. I mean, the birds are essentially just trying to keep things together, and they're improvising as they go under the threat of incredible violence if they improvise wrong. Ruth might be the character, Rebecca, who has a pretty interesting set of choices to make.
Absolutely. I mean, Rich is right. The word shrewd really sums her up for me. She's able to take in her surroundings. She's got the lay of the land in a way that the birds are never going to have. And she uses all these pieces to her advantage in a way to me. I mean, she's what, 19 years old, a young 19-year-old girl. And she acts more like an adult in her decision making and these sophisticated thought processes than Marty Bird, who is very much dictated by a lot of his passions and his feelings and his ignorance. And she doesn't have those same holdbacks. She's very able to assess what's going on and make these very cold, clinical decisions that are still very much informed by family. And to me, that was what made her a really fleshed out character and not just this ruthless young woman who's able to grab and get whatever she needs because that's her lot in life. But she does have these complicated loyalties that shift almost every episode and you can't quite pin down where she is episode to episode. And it just makes for an incredibly compelling watch. She is far and away my favorite character.
Absolutely.
I want to talk a little bit about women in this series. And so, I mean, the other main woman that we're getting to know is Wendy, wife of Marty Bird, played by Laura Linney, in the kind of extended performance I've wanted to see Laura Linney do for a bunch of years here. this is also not a spoiler. This is just like right here at the beginning of the series. It turns out that the other kind of secret that's going on in the Byrd family is a much more pedestrian one than laundering money for a drug cartel. Wendy is having an affair. This is something that follows her around for the rest of the series, and particularly in terms of Marty, who turns out to be the unforgiving type about this kind of thing. Anyway, let's hear a little bit of Wendy and Marty talking about a little bit about the affair and a little bit also just about what are we going to tell the kids.
What's our story for the kids?
What do you mean?
Well, they see this polite dance that we're doing in front of them. They hear the constant edge in your voice.
Well, we could tell them the truth, Wendy. How would that be?
Oh, you know what, Marty? Before you get too comfortable up there on your cross and have your pity party, let me just jog your memory for a minute. There was an innocent man who was murdered. Gary. He was a good man. He only did good things in this world, not like Bruce. Gary was a father. He had two grown sons. I never met them, but I know he loved them. And he was thrown off his balcony. For what? People cheat. They have sex with people who they aren't married to. It happens. It's not unique.
So one of my biggest questions about this whole series, and Susan, I'll start with you about this, is there's a way in which Marty can't forgive his wife, Wendy, for this act of infidelity, even though there are things happening right now that are much more earth-shattering and threatening to the family and to everybody's lives than this. And one of the things that I couldn't really decide is whether or not the series can forgive Wendy. There's a way in which the series, the script writers, the director, you know, are constantly inviting us to think that there's something wrong with Marty, that he can't let go of this thing. But there's also – I feel like this whole series has a kind of pitiless eye on Wendy too, that it also somehow or other won't let go of this thing. Some of that might be Linney's performance too. I don't know. What's your read on that?
I didn't get that impression that the series was nailing her on the cross herself for what she did. I got the impression that absolutely Marty can't move on. It looks like he might at some point, but I more got the impression that she's every bit as big and good a grifter as he is and able to fit into any role possible. And I think it's a wonderful performance. And I don't look at her as an object of pity or she doesn't have the big A on her chest. She's moving on.
So to me, in that scene that we just played, the turning point where Linney actually, to me, was let off the hook was the statement that that Marty made to her immediately after that, which, well, since we played so much of it and we know that her lover died, he made a statement to her after she just poured her heart out to him, you know, and was as raw as, you know, and you heard it, but to see her perform it is a whole other thing. And he made a statement to her, something to the effect of the moment that he heard that guy's head hit the sidewalk,
right,
that was the best moment of of his life at that point.
That's true. I've forgotten.
And
she slaps him.
Oh,
yeah,
a couple of times.
That. Open hand.
Yeah, and there was something about that moment that defined that transcended to her point. The things that we do and got to who we are, you know, and it redefined the rest of the show from that point for me to not about what we do, but who are we at our essence. And so in that regards, I think that she was completely let off the hook.
I first of all, I think that's all really good and really true, although it's not as though that's the end of it, you know. In other words, the script comes back to this question again and again. Another script at the end of those two slaps might have said, all right, that's as much as we're going to get out of this particular topic. But the script comes back to it over and over again. And I'm not really pushing this one way or another, but I was interested in the portrayal of women in this thing. Women are very strong in many cases in this thing. You can make the argument that Wendy almost has a better grip on what's going on than Marty does. We've talked a little bit about Ruth, who's really this very smart bootstraps sociopath, who on the one hand is really admirable in the sense that she's interested in bettering herself, but she's either, depending on your point of view, a cold-blooded killer or at least murder curious. And
that's going to go viral, murder curious.
And then, you know, we've got this other couple, the Snells, who are up in the hills a little bit, and they have their own criminal enterprise. And he is in many ways this very stolid a man of few words and doesn't show his hand very much. But his wife really is kind of a bloodthirsty maniac, sometimes gratifyingly, but she's the one with a wild look in her eye who might do anything at any minute. And so I don't know, Rebecca, I was sort of wondering about this, whether this series is tough on women or not afraid to present us with women as the actors, the sure. people who, you know.
I mean, I think in a lot of ways it reverses these traditional gender roles that are assigned to a lot of characters. The women behave in traditionally more masculine roles. Mrs. Snell is the one who's very violent. Mr. Snell wants to talk stuff through more. Wendy is able to become very ruthless very fast. And Wendy in particular, I think the most important episode for her arc was the flashback episode that comes towards the end of the series, Kaleidoscope, that shows some of her backstory 10 years prior and the transition she's made from being a woman without a place, unfulfilled in her marriage, unfulfilled by raising children, can't get a job because she's been out of work for a few years. And to see how that 10 years on, she's able to take this world-shattering news that her husband's laundering money and they've got to flee. And instead of having this complete meltdown, she pulls herself up by her bootstraps, gets everyone in control. My favorite, and I don't think this is really a spoiler either, my favorite scene for her was when she just straight up tells the children exactly what's going on. There's none of this Walter White trying to hide everything from his family. All the family's on board. The young teenage daughter is very, you know, she doesn't have a teenage meltdown about it. She doesn't go off and tell her parents' secrets. She plays right into it. So I do think there's a certain strength that's afforded to these women that I don't see very often in television shows. And I don't think it's necessarily them being harsh on the women. I think it's just a refreshing take on the traditional role in this. And Marty tends to be the one who's a little more emotional, a little more hung up on the affair. He's not willing to let that go as much as the female characters are able to kind of move past some of the emotional baggage.
There's something about Marty's character, though, that the emotional aspect that he portrays also feels strategic.
Yeah.
You know, it feels to me, as with all of his responses to the universes that he's in, that he's constantly playing, you know, trying to figure out what the risk reward.
He's playing an emotional game, like a traditional feminine role would be, more so mm-hmm. than the aggressor.
That's an interesting point. I think you nailed something there. Well, so comparisons to Breaking Bad, I think, are inevitable
yes.
here. And each series is about a rather normal-looking man who turns out to be a sociopath. And I, when I was writing about Breaking Bad, I was unsettled to encounter this large male fan base that did not regard Walter White as a monster, but regarded him as
said Skyler was the monster.
Exactly,
that
yes. The Walter White, so if you've never heard of Breaking Bad, Walter White is this former chemistry teacher, high school chemistry teacher, who becomes a meth kingpin. There were people who were very critical on social media of his wife Skyler, calling her basically an unsupportive bitch because she wasn't supporting his drug kingpin behavior. But he was really kind of regarded by some people as this kind of American Nietzsche, you know, this independent guy standing up to the man and yeah. self-actualized and making his own destiny. And so, Susan, I mean, as we look at this particular series, I, everybody's kind of a monster, right? With just a very few exceptions. Charlotte, the daughter you've mentioned, the world's oldest 15-year-old. And there's a woman named Rachel who runs the Blue Cat. She seems like a fairly normal person. Oddly enough, the sheriff of this area seems to be like kind of a regular guy who just can't believe he's surrounded by so many.
Oh, but he's on the take.
Yeah.
I don't think they're monsters. And maybe
that's where I wanted to go.
Yeah, I don't think they're monsters. And my standard of calling someone a sociopath is way low or higher than yours, because I don't look at Julia Garner's character as a sociopath. I look at her as living in a world of situational ethics, and I thought your point, Rich, about her being able to shift her loyalties to go in one particular case, to shift her loyalties outside of her family was stunning to me. Mm-hmm. And it spoke of her character, not that she was a monster. I don't think they're monsters. I think they're entertaining as all get out and not realistic. But the sheriff's on the take. This family's bemoaning the fact that their farm was flooded. Oh, my God. You can hear those stories out there all the time. It's boring. And, yes, you lost the Civil War. Move the hell on. But there's that family. So they've decided to be criminal in nature with the wife who's freaky in her violence. But I don't know. I don't think of them as monsters because every one of them at some point, maybe a couple of them know, have some redeeming quality. Like there's a scene where you go, oh, or where I would sit there and think, oh, okay. Like I'm not tense watching her, Julia Garner's character, interact with her cousins. Mm-hmm. Oh, they love each other. That's nice. So I'm able to, I don't know, be entertained.
So I'm going to make the people of color statement to this.
Are you representing?
I am representing.
Got it.
All of us. The Mexicans were the monsters in this. Everybody else, you could kind of understand the condition that they found themselves in.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But the Mexicans were the monsters. And when that didn't pan out, the response was, oh, well, they'll just send more Mexicans. Mm-hmm. You know. And there is something embedded in that I didn't really like very much at
Absolutely.
All.
And I can say watching it as a hillbilly, I'm thinking, oh, my God, if I was Mexican, this would be so old and tired to mm-hmm. me. Oh, look, the Mexican drug cartel. Well, of course.
Especially because they painted Del, who's the central villain, really interesting. I was very compelled by him. I wanted to figure out his motivations. The first episode, he tells this anecdotal story about a family member stealing money from a till, and that kind of becomes his barometer of judging the people he works with. And I thought that first episode, I thought we were going to get so much more out of him, and it was going to be so much interesting. And they kind of threw the character away and just replaced it with, as Rich says, more Mexicans and the ambiguous, baddie cartel Mexicans that don't really wear, they're not souls wearing flesh, they're just props. And that was frustrating.
But and sadistic on top of that.
Yeah.
Because there comes a point in which, you know, these folks are making some headway in what they need to accomplish.
Yeah.
And he just kind of shows up and cranks up the temperature, cranks up the timeline, you know, does stuff to interject things that accelerate the tension in this piece for no particular reason other than, you know, because the Mexicans are evil.
Okay,
so I want to go back to Marty Bird. This is the character who's played by Jason Bateman. And just once again, for those of you who haven't seen this series yet, just a reminder, he's a Chicago accountant who essentially of his own volition just becomes a money launderer for a drug cartel. And so if he's not a monster, I want to talk about why that is. I mean, it's sort of the Macbeth question, right? You know, is Macbeth always a monster whose latent monstrosity is just essentially undercovered? Or is Macbeth essentially a victim of a series of twists and turns which place him ultimately in a position where he does something monstrous? You know, this is like a gigantic question that probably runs through literature. Mm-hmm. I look at Marty and I think, I don't really know how you become a Mexican drug cartel kingpin. It's probably you do a lot of pretty horrible things, but I don't know how you get started on that. But I sort of know how Marty gets started. He makes a whole series of choices, which for the most part are sociopathic in nature, right? He decides that he's going to do this thing. He's going to deal with evil people who are in an evil business that mm-hmm. leaves a trail of broken lives and premature deaths. You know, I mean, I think Marty is a monster.
Yeah, I mean, in the same way that Macbeth, a lot of bad stuff happens to him, but it's that original first choice he makes that sets everything else into motion. So ultimately, it wasn't like Marty got conned into doing this. He made the choices, adult male choices, to participate in this. And
I think that the unfolding of the story here helps that as well. Because we are knee-deep in the ramifications of the choices that he makes within the first 20 minutes of this series.
It's very in media res. It starts right in the thick of it.
You're right deep in the middle of it. And somewhere, you know, around episode 6 or 7 or so of these first 10 episodes, we start getting a sense of how Marty got to make the decision that he made. I don't think that I would make those decisions, you know, looking at the life that he already had.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I understand the decisions that the folks who are living in a trailer in the Ozark are making. But considering, you know, maybe it's just part of my idea that let's all get to this sort of minimum base of what we all have and everything else is gravy. He is well past that minimum base of what we should all have.
He's greedy. Yeah. He said the opening monologue of the show is him moving money from one place to another and talking all about his relationship to money and how the pursuit of money comes above everything else for him, above family. He uses that when he does this great scene where he's trying to psych himself up to confront his wife. And he's like, and I've worked all day. I could have had all these affairs, but I've worked. I've made all this money. I've worked. And it's like, oh, Marty.
We should say there is something very comical about
it's Jason Bateman.
About all this stuff, you know, like almost everything that's scary has kind of a funny little moment to it. Mm-hmm. Even the little soliloquy that we heard Laura Linney talk about this former lover of hers who's dead, and she says, and he had adult sons. I never met them.
But he loved them.
But last question. We really have to move on to the next thing, and this is a big can of worms I'm about to open up, but maybe, Susan, you can just sort of get us through it really quickly. Every time now – so the difference between, say, Justified, which is also a little bit like this, and Ozark, is that now every time we look at something like this, we do have to ask ourselves questions about the big orange elephant in the room and the 2016 election. And so – When I used to watch Justified, I never thought, well, those are probably people who feel as though, you know, they're not getting their share of the American dream, so they have to do these things and they'll probably vote for some really inappropriate person for president someday. But now I'm sort of wondering whether it's necessary or even useful to read a series like Ozark that way and say, well, I guess we're looking at some of the people who ultimately thought they had to make some – my sense is the Snells, they're the people who grow poppies up in the hills – don't vote.
I was
going to
say, my sense is many of those people didn't vote, and there is no excuse.
Why create another paper trail by voting?
Why? No, it's the government, so there's not a. I don't know what the voting turnout is in that part of Missouri. It's low everywhere, but no, I would not use Ozark as an explanation for why Donald Trump is our president.
All right. We have to go take a break right now. We've got to come back. We're going to talk about Sam Shepard. We might talk a little bit about Sharknado, which one of our regular panelists, Carolyn Payne, this is going to be like the centerpiece of her summer, Sharknado 5. We are back. Welcome back to The Nose. Special hello to Charlie Cameron, who's our guest producer today, along with the regular production team here. And we're talking to Susan Campbell, the author of the upcoming bestseller Searching for the American Dream in Frog Hollow. Rebecca Castellani is Queen of the Endles, Warden of the North, and Entertainment Director at Bridge Street Live in Canton. Rich Holland is Principal and Design Director at CoLab. So on Monday, we got the news that Sam Shepard had died. Our Monday scramble often is intended to react to breaking news. There's so much breaking news these days. And I said to Jonathan, we can't remake the show at this point to get Sam Shepard in there. But we also thought, well, people will – there's a lot of things going on and maybe things like this don't get the proper treatment. And it would be at least interesting to talk to the people on the Nose about what their most memorable Sam Shepard moment is, whether it's a role that he played or a play that he wrote or maybe some other thing that he symbolizes. Rich, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to set you up here with a clip from The Right Stuff where, in fact, Sam Shepard played Chuck Yeager, the test pilot, the real-life test pilot who was too cool and too daring to really want to be an astronaut.
Hey, Ridley.
Yeah.
You got any Beamans?
I might have me a stick.
Well, loan me some, would you? I'll pay you back later.
Fair enough.
Think I see a plane over here with a name on it.
Now you talk.
This turns out to be a mildly superstitious ritual that these two men have. Every time Chuck Yeager takes a plane up, they have that conversation about the stick of Beeman's gum. So, Rich, take it away.
Okay. So they did that three times in this movie, and each time the risks grew. If I recall correctly, the thing with Yeager is it wasn't so much that he didn't want to be an astronaut, but he didn't have the education to be an astronaut. That they were picking guys that that were all sort of college grads and had a level of elitism that he as a sort of common hero didn't possess. He wasn't the bow-tied John Glenn at all. He was another character. He played another character. And I think in our exchanges, it was like, I think he played a character that got out of the Ozark and ended up on as a test pilot, where the value of his life came down to his willingness to put it on the line all the time, chasing the envelope of sound and the envelope of speed. And Sam Shepard embodied that role in a way that that I couldn't imagine anybody else doing. Initially, he was that sort of swaggery guy. But in that scene that we just played, Sam came out in, you know, what amounts to what looks very much like a Mercury astronaut outfit to fly this thing. And he was a good foot taller than all of the other astronauts that were going to do this work. And the whole scene was, it was silver and shiny and glistening, and he felt like this alien being that just got landed to do this transcendent thing. Every time I've seen Sam Shepard, he was that guy. He was this stoic, rugged, American West kind of figure that also had this warm sensitivity. You got the sense that that he was always down on his luck a little bit, but endured. And I just wonder, and I've been wondering since Monday, if the time for that is actually over in this country. Are we really at the point where the Glenn Scotts and the Sam Shepherds are leaving us? Because I'm not seeing anything that replaces that. It's being replaced with a kind of cynicism. It's being replaced with something other. And I think that we will be longing that.
All right. We shouldn't have let Rich go first, because now it's going to sound like none of us have anything cool to say. That was really good. although I will say my recollection of the Chuck Yeager character is that he's contemptuous of what the space program is. In fact, in Wolf's book, the test pilots are all going, a monkey's going to make the first flight. That's what they think about this, is that you really can't control the thing the way they want to control a plane. They don't want to do this. They don't understand what all the fuss is about. You know, it's not really what test pilots do. All right, Susan, you're up.
Oh, great. yes to all of that. I never saw Sam Shepard on stage, but his plays, and I'm thinking particularly Curse of the Starving Class, just felt rawly, R-A-W-L-Y, honest to me, as did he feel to me. And again, never met him. My husband saw him at a theater once in New York. That's as close as I ever came. But he struck me as an artist of incredible integrity. Like, he spoke his truth and he never wavered from that. And I admire that very much.
I do wonder, the only two plays that I really know are True West and Fool for Love. Mm-hmm. And I saw the Sam Rockwell, Nina Aranda revival of Fool for Love on Broadway last year. And it did strike me as a play that, first of all, I think moving these things to the Broadway stage may be kind of a mistake. I think Sam Shepard's stuff often belongs on a smaller kind of downtown stage with a smaller audience.
Or Long Wharf.
Yeah. I mean, just whatever the pressure is of a Broadway situation, things have to get blown up into a level that I think he is much more of that kind of minimalist writer who's going to work better in a smaller environment. And I also think it's kind of an open question how well these plays stand the test of time. I couldn't tell you 50 years from now whether people will still be doing these shows or not. I mean, it sounds like you think so.
I do, but
Rebecca, you just read Buried Child, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was not familiar with Sam Shepard other than I've seen him in stuff and I know his face. I loved him in Bloodline, didn't really know his name until Monday. And one of my beloved theater friends from Holy Cross had posted a status about, you know, she was mourning his loss and loved Buried Child, and she's the consummate expert on this stuff, so I decided I was going to read it, and I was bowled over by it. I really was not anticipating. I mean, it was Eugene O'Neill for the American industrial crisis. It was wonderful. It was complicated. It was heartbreaking. It was, the writing was not overblown. It felt very true to the moment. The setting of the play itself seemed to match the dialogue in a way that I thought was really impressive. And I certainly will continue to explore more of Sam Shepard. It's too bad that it takes him passing away for me to discover him, but I am sorry I didn't do so sooner.
Well, I want to circle back to Rich's point, too. First of all, one thing that I feel about Sam Shepard is that he is that actor who's often dropped in for you know, an 8 to 10 minute performance in the middle of a movie, which makes you wish that the role were bigger as opposed to an awful lot of actors. I just heard him earlier today on Fresh Air where she had an old interview with him, and he talked about how he didn't like a lot of those parts. He felt as though they were all the same person, or they weren't they didn't seem like real characters and stuff. But he, you know, I don't know. I saw him – the last thing I might have seen him in is a show, movie called Midnight Express, which came out I think last year. It's kind of a lot like the movie Starman, except that it's a kid instead of Jeff Bridges. And he plays kind of a cult leader who's on for – I don't know how much screen time he has. Not very much, but then you wish that he had more screen time, which is not that many actors make you do that. But Rich, I also liked your point that in a way, I don't know, like who's the long, tall, rugged man of few words who – there's a lot of men of few words, but they don't make you wish that they would tell you some more words.
No, they don't have they don't have that thing that lies behind that ruggedness. You know, they don't have the warmth. And I believe that that's who he was. It wasn't what he was performing. You know, I think that he was genuinely connected to those two sides. And I remember there was some scene that I'd seen somewhere. It might have been out of a play where he was having a conversation. And it was a kind of difficult conversation. He was playing with a lighter, and there's just this glimpse of delight that just touched the corner of his mouth ever so slightly, looking at that flame, and then went back to the conversation. I mean, who does that? I mean, nobody's bringing that kind of joy in these little tiny, you know, contained moments.
Rich, I can think of one person who does that.
Who?
And that would be Mark Cuban in Sharknado 2. That's just where he plays the president of the United States. Let's hear a little bit of that.
I thought your policy was to save the sharks.
Nobody attacks my house. This time is personal.
Yeah, that would be Mark.
That was the crappiest segue ever.
That is the only way to introduce Sharknado.
Oh,
that hurt me.
So
my heart hurts.
The provenance of that little clip, just so that you know, and this has come out this week in coverage as we get ready to welcome Sharknado 5 into our lives, is that in fact, they had been in negotiations with Sarah Palin to play the president of the United States in that particular version, iteration, whatever it was. It's either 2 or 3. I can't remember which. And talks broke down for whatever reason.
Darn.
Whereupon they approached a person named Donald Trump, who seemed very interested at that point in playing the president of the United States in Sharknado. Just let that sink in for a second.
And one would have thought that would have been the only way, the only path for President Trump to be.
And if they had just reached out to him 2 weeks earlier.
We could have all been saved.
So anyway,
thanks, Sharknado.
Yeah.
He agreed to do it. They couldn't get in touch with him for a long time after he agreed to do it. They finally decided he was never going to get back to them. I think they are no strangers to rejection. So they concluded he just wasn't interested anymore. At that point, they hired Mark Cuban to play the president of the United States, at which point Donald Trump, through his lawyer, Michael Cohen, threatened to sue them for hiring somebody other than Donald Trump to play the president of the United States, and said that they were going to get everything back from them and hurt them in language that is very familiar to us now. They basically said that they were going to take everything that the makers of Sharknado had for this terrible offense. So but that's not why I want to talk about Sharknado. Not exactly. It is sort of true that there are a lot of people who really enjoy it. Carolyn Payne, who is a regular panelist on The Nose, is planning a big event this weekend. She's trying to set up a backyard projector somewhere. This is much more interesting to Carolyn than Game of Thrones or Ozark or any other peak TV. And I sort of wonder about that. Like, you know, why – I wonder. There is some joy in highly calculated badness. So you're about to say something. So that means you have to say something.
Oh gosh,
no, well, you shouldn't have made that noise.
Thank you. I think that bad is a response to. Okay, so this is going to be idiotic. I'm going a little too far out on this, right?
Reel me back in.
I think that it's a response to how much culture that we could be looking at. Things that are more highbrow through. It's a response to elitism. It's a response to thoughtfulness to an excess. And I do believe that that's feasible. You know, I think that we can analyze a thing and think about a thing and, you know, and pontificate to a point that we kill a thing, you know. And I personally get a lot of delight from schlock. Mm-hmm. I see it. I enjoy it. I move on. I don't talk about it on the radio. But
mm-hmm. No,
but
I think it's
a guilty pleasure.
I think you're dead on, you know, that there is – there's a way in which, Rebecca, you know, there's a whole group of people who don't want to watch Game of Thrones and then watch it a second time and then listen to a podcast about it and then start.
What are you implying? I mean, I certainly like my escapist TV once in a while. This is just not my cup of tea. I think it's a little over the top and a little too absurd. And I do think that there are better, worse things to be watching, if that makes sense. But, you know, I'm not about to knock what someone else enjoys. If you enjoy Sharknado, more power to you. I couldn't sit through more than 5 minutes of it. But, you know, everyone's got a different cup of tea.
I think, Susan, there also might be an art to being bad intentionally. You know, like, people do stuff that's really bad because they're trying to do something good and they don't know how. We're very familiar with that. But these people have really gone out and tried to do this, right?
I would rather pull out my eyes with a pair of pliers, rusty pair of pliers, and eat my eyes than spend much time on Sharknado. And that I don't get it. And I probably have guilty pleasures. It just doesn't usually involve a screen with crap on it. I can't watch it.
All right.
I'm sorry.
You should save your eyes in case you have to mail them in a jar to somebody. But We can't explain to you what we mean by that.
No.
All right. So we're going to take a little break instead. We're going to come back. We're going to recommend some things to you.
You tell these sharks to stop biting these snakes on this plane! Today's show was produced by Pants Nato and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish is not a shark. The part of Bill Curry was played by Fabio. On Monday's show, we'll be back with the scramble, unless the grand jury calls us in. And now, back to Colin.
All right. I've been asked by the people in the control room to issue a correction. It is Sharknado 3, in which Mark Cuban is the president, not Sharknado 2. We're not fake news here. You know, if we make a mistake, we fix it right away. And Rebecca also pointed out that there's probably four alumni from The Apprentice who also have been in Sharknado. We essentially have elected Sharknado to run our country, if you think about it that way. All right. So it's time to recommend some things. So let's start with Rebecca.
Okay. Well, I read a great book this week. I read it in a day. It's called Slade House by David Mitchell. It is kind of a haunted house horror story. It's got a lot of strange, perverse humor in it that I was very compelled by. It's technically considered like a long footnote to one of his other books, The Bone Clocks. He's one of those writers that all of his books have some sort of subtle connection, so it's also connected to Cloud Atlas and some of the themes in that. I've never read Mitchell before this week, and I was really bowled over by it. You know, it's a rare day now with a busy schedule that I binge a book. And I really did binge it, stayed up all night reading it. So highly recommend that. My second recommendation was a new artist I come across this weekend at the Newport Folk Festival, Billy Bragg. He's by no means new, but he was incredible. Mm-hmm. Talk about some good resistance music. So if you're looking to get your activity going, I would highly recommend listening to some Billy Bragg in the morning, and you'll be resisting all day.
All right. Susan?
Okay, two things. One, please someone buy the Astrophysics for People in a Hurry book by Neil deGrasse Tyson and then explain it to me. I got two pages in, which I looked at it as Astrophysics for Dummies. I did not make it past two pages, and I very much want to understand astrophysics. The other thing is the Cardinals are coming to Boston in a week or so, and if you're in Boston on August 15th, please wear your Cardinals T-shirt so that I will not be the only one in Fenway Park. Go Cards.
Oh, all right.
You
get no help from me there. All right. Rich, what have you got for us?
So I have a two-in-one. We've been having discussions in our office about the role that design thinking can play in community organizing and working on rejiggering one to fit into the – re-engineering one to fit into the other. And this weekend – every time my kids turn a certain age, like 5 to 7, we watch two movies back to back. and I make them watch it. And I'm going to be on my fifth time of making a kid watch this thing. And it sparks this sense of wonder and curiosity about the world in them. And that double feature will be, and it ties back to what we're working in the office on as well, The Right Stuff, followed by Apollo 13. And I replay that scene in Apollo 13 where they have a table and all the stuff that could possibly be on the plane. And all of the engineers that were sitting in their siloed spaces stand around the table and try to figure out what to do with a sock. And it's an inspiring, wonderful thing, and everybody should go watch those two movies.
So you do this with a different set of two movies every year?
No, same two.
Same two?
Same two. So I've got five kids.
Yeah.
Each time they turn somewhere between 5 and 7 when I remember to do it, we watch these two movies
wow.
back to forth.
That's
and
so
back
cool.
back to back. And my my oldest son, for a couple years there, watched Apollo 13 every day, sometimes 2 or 3 times a day, wearing a little spacesuit.
I'm so glad you said That's this awesome. Because on the way in the drive over here, I was talking to Charlie Cameron, our new producer, who's 11, and I was talking to him about The Right Stuff, which he's never heard of. But I was thinking, that is a – I mean, it's a movie that really will hold up pretty well, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just thought it was a terrific movie. I've probably seen it 4 or 5 times. Has a whole generation of actors who we then got to know in lots of other ways. I mean, just it's kind of an amazing cast too. So that's a great concept. I think other people should do that actually. All right. So I can, by the way, double down on Slade House by David Mitchell. I read it too. I read it in the spooky house up in Canada, which made me even more scared. I scare easily anyway. I'm going to recommend food. Just generally, you should take nutrition, but also specifically so Plainville isn't necessarily a place that you think of as a place to, you know, it's not an entertainment mecca. Let's just put it that way. They have a restaurant there called El Pulpo. It's a Spanish restaurant. It was recommended by Betsy Kaplan, our producer. It's always a good idea to go anywhere that Betsy Kaplan tells you to, although she may have told me to go certain places I'm not eager to go. And it's really a tremendous Spanish restaurant. It's just a little gem sitting in a strip mall, and it's really amazingly good. So El Pulpo for really, really good Spanish food, and not like super expensive either. The other thing I am going to recommend is something that I sort of alluded to last week. I just want to kind of stress it one more time. I think as we all reach a certain age, this is not necessarily Rebecca's problem, but as we all reach a certain age, it's harder and harder to seek out new music, but it's really worth doing. What I'm sort of going to recommend is building an hour into your week, just using whatever means you can. I happen to be on the streaming service Tidal, which unfortunately these days only ever wants me to listen to Jay-Z because he has a new album out and he owns part of the company. But if you go past that, they have all these sort of little suggested playlists and different ideas. And yeah, I mean, Wolfie is typing SZA out to me, which SZA is amazing. SZA is coming to Toad's Place, I think, in the fall. Yeah. But I discovered SZA that way. But that's just a nice example, though. I mean, there's just so much incredible stuff that's out there. And I think as we get older, we have our little collections and our playlists and stuff like that and the stuff that we know and trust, and we wind up missing a ton of stuff, and we just think that it's all Katy Perry and Taylor Swift and therefore deserving of whatever contempt we might direct towards that. And it's just not. They're just really interesting, exciting, musical people who are coming up with new stuff all the time. So whatever strategy you come up with, it doesn't matter, you know, but come up with a strategy. So like an hour a week, you're going to spend just sitting there listening to some music you've never heard before and then deciding, you know, as they used to say on the hip hop radio station next door to the old radio station where I worked, they had a thing called crunk it or chunk it. So you can just, each song, you can decide to either it's crunk or you're going to chunk it. That made a lot of sense back in the 90s. It doesn't make any sense now. All right. So on that fine note, thanks to our wonderful panel today. It has been great to talk to you guys. We'll be back. We'll be live from New Haven next week on The Nose. It'll be our final performance ever in the Audubon Street Studios, which we are relinquishing, which we are eagerly relinquishing. It is the only radio studio in America that has no clock in it. So we might just bring a clock next week so we can do the only show we've ever had where we actually knew what time it was. Thanks so much to Susan Campbell. Search out Searching for the American Dream in Frog Hollow when it is published. Rebecca Castellani, well, she wants you to go see whatever's playing at Bridge Street Live, probably in Canton, not SZA for now anyway, probably. But and Rich Holland is principal and design director at CoLab. He just planned your weekend for you, those two movies, and we'll be back on Monday.
Hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington,
yeah, 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 yeah.